This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The CIA is in trouble. It's been accused of incompetence for allowing Aldrich Ames to remain in the agency years after clues indicated he might be a Soviet mole. The agency is also under attack for its sexist culture. And Congress is about to appoint an independent commission to rethink the CIA's role, its structure, power, and budget, and whether it should continue to exist at all. My guest Tim Weiner covers the CIA for the New York Times. He is also the author of the book Blank Check, The Pentagon's Black Budget. We asked him to review what's happening with the CIA. I asked what happened to the plan CIA Director James Woolsey was supposed to come up with to redefine the agency in the post-Cold War world.
Jim Woolsey wears two hats, okay? And I'm sure he wishes at times that he had two heads. He has to run the Central Intelligence Agency, and he is chairman of the board of all U.S. intelligence agencies, as well as being the CEO of the CIA. And he has been asked repeatedly to come up with some overarching vision for the entire U.S. intelligence community, and Congress has sort of now taken that away from him in the form of this commission. As for the CIA, well, there are a lot of problems out there now. The Aldrich Ames spy case, which broke 8 months ago, has really damaged morale. Not so much his treason, but the picture of almost unbelievable incompetence that has emerged as the agency essentially confesses that it was told back in 1986, a few months after Ames began to spy for the Soviet Union, that he was probably a very bad man and, in essence, for the next 7 years, did very, very little about it.
Well, Woolsey last week decided not to single out anyone in the CIA to take the fall for the failure to get rid of Aldrich Ames, and no one's going to be dismissed or demoted, although there were 11 letters of reprimand sent to former and present CIA officials. How is that playing in the intelligence community?
Well, you have to appreciate the difficulty of his position. He has to at once confess error publicly. And in fairness, errors had happened largely before he took over CIA in February 1993. And he has to try not to further damage morale at this very battered agency. It's a very, very difficult position, and I'm sure that he feels that it was an almost impossible one.
You say that the CIA is seen as incompetent for not getting Aldrich Ames sooner. What were the early signs that something was wrong with his performance?
Well, it's a long litany. Rick Ames joined the CIA in 1962. He was a legacy, so to speak. His father had been in the agency. He had a remarkably undistinguished career, first serving overseas in Turkey, then returning to the United States, working for a time in the 1970s in New York, focused on the United Nations, and then a truly disastrously bad tour in the CIA's station in Mexico City in 1981, 82, and early 83. At the time he returned to Washington in 1983, he was undergoing a messy divorce from a former CIA officer. He was sleeping with a foreigner whom he later married, who had been a recruited agent of the CIA. That's against the rules. He was broke. He was drunk most of the time. He was a slacker. He had a reputation as Deadwood, a somewhat derelict employee, and he had dangerously unorthodox views about the way of the world.
Like what?
Well, he now says, and I've interviewed him at length, that he had an emerging vision that it would be better for the world if the Soviet if the spies that the CIA had inside the Soviet Union were to disappear, that if they were to disappear, then reformers, should they come, could convincingly argue that the problems of communism were self-inflicted and not the result of an American plot. It's a twisted and a very self-justifying argument, but he says it was growing inside his head at this time period. This would be 83 or so. So what does the CIA do with this lazy, incompetent, arrogant, drunken employee? It gives him one of the most sensitive jobs in the shop, which is running the counterintelligence branch of the Soviet division of the clandestine service.
How was he recruited by the Soviets?
He recruited himself. He walked into the Soviet embassy in April 1985. He was authorized at the time to go to the Soviet embassy to attempt to recruit officials there. And he sat down with an embassy officer, and he, in exchange for $50,000, sold them the names of two Soviets who were secretly working for the United States. Several months later, he showed up and, he says, voluntarily, essentially gave them the keys to the kingdom, a list of names of every important Soviet intelligence officer, military officer, and private citizen who was secretly working for the United States.
And some of them were killed.
At least 10 died. Ames then says, to his surprise, the Soviets told him they had set aside $2 million in gratitude. The intelligence relationship continued for the next 8.5 years.
So as a result of his work with the Soviets, Ames comes into a lot of money, and he spends that money in very ostentatious ways. He buys a Jaguar, he buys a new, real expensive home.
For cash.
For cash, okay. And the CIA doesn't investigate it. What did he tell the CIA about how he got the money?
He was confronted with this in 1990. A fellow employee had raised a red flag, and not the first, about Ames, saying essentially, good God, how did this man come into this money? And Ames says that he explained that his wife, Rosario, had come into a fortune from the death of her father. The CIA then belatedly mounts a search the next year for the will of her father in Colombia, and after a apparently very half-hearted and hapless effort, decides it can't find it. It's worse than this. In 1985, Ames, who, as we said, was authorized to visit the Soviet embassy in Washington as part of his job, stops reporting his visits to the embassy. He's showing up at the Soviet embassy without clearing it with his superiors. Now, if you're in the clandestine service, you want your bosses to know that you are visiting the Soviet embassy, that you are doing your job. This is how you get your ticket punched. So for Ames to not report these visits could mean only two things. One, that he was uninterested in advancing his career, or two, that he was a spy for the Soviet Union. In 1985, the FBI, which was regularly monitoring the Soviet embassy in Washington, asked the CIA, hey, how come your guy is making all these visits? Ames is confronted with this, does nothing, the CIA forgets about it. So the flag was raised, really, 8 years before Ames was caught.
What's the CIA's explanation for not ferreting Ames out sooner?
It is a remarkably detailed and remarkably self-critical self-portrait of incompetence and indifference. Its explanation begins with the fact that it kept promoting Ames because people wanted to get rid of him because he was such a rotten employee. So they'd fob him off on another division, in this case, tragically, the Soviet division, in 1983 onward. This is a standard bureaucratic practice known as turkey farming. to get rid of an unwanted employee. It says it failed to focus on this direct evidence because there was almost a reluctance to concede that there might be a traitor within and that the traitor might be one of us. I talked with a longtime FBI counterintelligence officer about this, and he said, well, you go to the CIA and tell them you're penetrated. And they say, no, we're not. You go back and you say, you're penetrated. There is a traitor in your ranks. And they say, well, it's probably a technical problem. It's probably a bug or a wiretap somewhere, but it can't be a person. And the FBI guy sighed and said, well, it almost always is a person.
Do you think that the CIA was reluctant to admit that there might be a turncoat within the agency because it would make the agency look bad?
That is conceivable. That is conceivable. The consequences of catching him were comparable to the consequences of not catching him. Do you follow me?
Right, that they'd be hurt either way. And so is one theory that people who were in more powerful positions in the CIA maybe had more to lose by exposing the spy than allowing him to continue?
You have to remember that there was a lot of other stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in 1986, according to the former director of Central Intelligence, Bob Gates, who I spoke to about this, by 1986, within a year after Ames has given up most of the keys to the kingdom, the network of Soviet agents working for the CIA begins to fall apart. People begin disappearing. People begin dying. And it was as if searchlights lit up the Kremlin saying, you're penetrated. There is a spy in your ranks. Now, almost simultaneously with this, the CIA's role in the cash for the Contras and arms for the Ayatollah machinations of the Iran-Contra affair are beginning to become unraveled. People were, to say the least, distracted. Several months later, William J. Casey, the head of the CIA under Ronald Reagan, falls into a coma as a consequence of a brain tumor that kills him. Within a few weeks, there's an enormous to-do at the Soviet embassy in Moscow. Wiretaps, bugs have been discovered. Perhaps the Marine Guards there have been working with the Soviets. One can understand the failure to focus in this period. What is harder to understand is that from 1987 to 1991, the head of the CIA was William Webster, the former head of the FBI, and one could not imagine a person better situated to make FBI-CIA cooperation in a matter like this take place, to make sure that it took place. This is when the mole hunt essentially ceased. And that is still an unexplained chapter in this story.
Meanwhile, what are the current proposals to try to make sure that if there is a next time like this, the CIA turns the information over promptly to the FBI so that the FBI can investigate
right.
who the mole is?
Congress has put this into law in the intelligence bill for next year. The bill passed Congress last week.
My guest is Tim Weiner. He covers the CIA for the New York Times. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the CIA with New York Times reporter Tim Weiner. Now, there's another current case that's calling into question operations within the CIA, and I'm thinking of the gender discrimination case. Do you want to tell us about that one?
Sure. The case in question is a federal suit styled Jane Doe Thompson versus R. James Woolsey. The woman in question had a stellar career, by all accounts, at the CIA and rose to become the first woman to be appointed station chief in a Latin American country. She was sent down to Jamaica in 1991 as station chief. She inherited a real snake pit, as the way she describes it in her suit. A lot of head cases. The place was a dumping ground for some misfits who worked at the agency. When she attempted to discipline them, they then turned the tables on her and mounted a series of what she says are false allegations that she had suddenly become a heavy drinking sexual temptress, which everyone who knows her says is out of character. That's not the woman they know. Then to further complicate matters, the agency said, great job in Jamaica. We're going to make you station chief in Prague, which is a very prominent position. That offer was withdrawn, she says, after her deputy-to-be said, I will not work for a woman. The combination of what she says are the false allegations against her of personal sexual excesses and excessive drinking, and this withdrawal of this proffered promotion have put her in limbo in a windowless cubicle at CIA headquarters. And when I began to look into her story, I began to get an outpouring of calls from people who had been her bosses at CIA, who had worked with her at CIA. Many went on the record for the first time in their lives or submitted to the first interview they'd ever done in their lives and allowed their names to be used and said, this is a great woman. And she's being done an injustice.
What do you know now about what the CIA has been authorized to do in Haiti?
Well, the New York Times has reported that it's been authorized to carry out a limited series of programs that could help get the parliament up and running and could help carry out the policy of the return of President Aristide. In the past, the agency has had links, which it has severed now, with some key members of the anti-Aristide junta. And it's a very good argument to make that it should have had those links since it could figure out what was going on better by getting reports from these guys. The problem becomes when you're relying on Aristide's opponents as reporting, as reporters, as sources of information, will that skew or bias your reporting on Aristide? And such allegations have been made fairly convincingly.
The CIA did a psychological profile of Aristide and said he was basically mentally unstable. I know that conclusion has been challenged. What do you know about how that conclusion was reached?
There are a number of problems with the psychological portrait of President Aristide that the agency produced. one allegation in it, which is that he had been treated for depression or mental illness at a Canadian hospital in 1980, is demonstrably false. Very sympathetic portraits of President Aristide, such as Amy Wilentz's in her book The Rainy Season, acknowledge that he had bouts of depression, that he had spells of emotional weakness or instability, if you will. But you could say that about a lot of foreign leaders. It certainly doesn't make him unqualified to hold office. The agency, it should be remembered, is an instrument of American foreign policy. And where American foreign policy is clear and coherent, the agency doesn't get crossways with it. In recent months, years, if you will, when American foreign policy has been somewhat confused on a number of issues because no one really knows where we're going after the Cold War or how to get there, the agency can be seen as somehow separate from the American foreign policy establishment. By and large, it's not. The CIA has always been a tool of American foreign policy. And with very few exceptions, very, very, very few exceptions, the agency has never been a rogue elephant in that famous phrase from the 1970s. Where it has sinned and where it has erred, it's not because it was a rogue elephant. It's because there was a rogue mahout, a rogue elephant driver, and that was the President of the United States. The coups the CIA engineered in the past, the botched assassination attempts in the early 1960s, these things were carried out at the direction of the White House, and they were not some sort of sinister secret plot that the agency did on its own. The problems, some of the problems that the CIA is experiencing now, are because it is a Cold War tool that has not been substantially reshaped for the post-Cold War world, and that it is an instrument of American foreign policy at a time when American foreign policy is confused.
What's President Clinton's relationship with the agency like now?
To the best anyone can figure, it's at a remove. The president's national security advisor, Tony Lake, is said to rely more on the State Department's intelligence analyses than on CIA's. Mr. Lake, of course, comes out of the State Department. Mr. Woolsey isn't... he doesn't have a seat at the table on a number of occasions where his predecessors would have. It's a difficult and sometimes strained relationship to the best of anyone's knowledge.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure, Terry.
Tim Weiner covers the CIA for the New York Times. He's also the author of Blank Check, The Pentagon's Black Budget. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.